this morning I'd like to talk... Is the mic working? Good. This morning I'd like to talk about emotion in Buddhism a little bit, and specifically anger. Where shall I start? I think I'll start with the aggregates, with the skandhas, which some of you know and some of you don't know at all. But in Buddhism, we talk about five aggregates. The first being form or contact, the second being sensation, the third being perception, the fourth being mental tendency, mental construction, or emotion. That's the translation I'm using today, emotion. The fifth being consciousness. So we have those five. And some of you know them pretty well. Let me give an example. I'm thinking who I'm going to pick on. Oh. Yes. Well, I'll pick on Guy. Guy looks like a good candidate. So, to run through these very fast, I'm looking over at Guy as I'm sitting here, and first skanda, the first aggregate is contact, physicality. And the second is, in this case, there's a negative sensation. The negative sensation is not because he's looking like this, but because he's looking like this. And here I'm just about to give this wonderful talk. This guy is already asleep, and I haven't even started. So that's the second one. The first one is the physicality of the contact. The second one is the sensation of unpleasant. This is unpleasant. The third one is the perception. Oh, drowsy, you know, drowsy. The fourth one is anger. And the fifth one is consciousness. What do I say about this whole thing? What do I say to myself? Consciousness. And consciousness generally, I mean, I'm just sort of categorizing consciousness that it does four things in response to the first four. That it either denies, that it represses, that it magnifies, or it generalizes. Consciousness is considered the fuel for the fire being the emotional one, being the mental tendency. Consciousness puts fuel on the fire. So let's say, okay, so with denial, let's say that, I'm just going to deny that. I'm going to say, oh, no, he's not sleepy. He's in a trance already. Because I don't want that, right? I need to be up for the rest of my talk. I can't have him sleeping already. So that would be denial. Repression would be just, I'm just repressing. I'm going on to my talk. It's going to come back and hit me later, as repression does, but not during my talk. Because the third thing I might do, either during the talk or afterwards, more likely afterwards, because during the talk there's not time to do this stuff, right? But I might do it during the talk. I magnify. So what's magnify? I magnify through my thinking, through my story. My magnify said, oh, that guy, there he goes again. You know, he's supposed to be a senior student, and here he is sleeping again. And I remember how he didn't do this and that and the other. And I'm putting fuel on the fire, right? I'm getting revved up. I'm getting the emotion all revved up. Or I generalize. I say, I notice Guy. Then I notice Rosemary. Rosemary also looks a little droopy. Then I notice way back in the room, Susan looks droopy. Everybody's drooping on me. And how will I ever get through this talk? Because I generalize, so my anger generalizes. This whole group of malcontents. Why do they even show up at all? Why do I even show up at all? And that reminds me, my wife this morning, and my cat peed on the rug, right? So this is what we do as human beings. This is what we do. And Buddhist practice, Zen practice, is bringing this into view. It's bringing it into view. That is our practice. The most powerful of the skandhas, again, the skandhas being the aggregates, form, sensation, perception, emotion, and consciousness is emotion, is making something out of it, making something out of your perceptual experience. It could be a positive emotion, it could be a negative emotion, but you're making something out of it. And emotion is not bad or good in Buddhism. It's just what is. Because in Buddhism, there really isn't any bad or good. But recognizing how powerful emotion is important, because emotion tends to drive our lives. For the most part, emotion, whatever it is, and of course they change, there's a whole constellation, they drive our lives. And in Buddhism, we talk about negative emotions or unwholesome emotions, and wholesome emotions or positive emotions. And sometimes we're driven by one, sometimes we're driven by the other. And not drive sounds negative, but actually it can be wonderfully positive. Look at someone like Barack Obama. He's smart. Well, we know he's smart. That's the fifth consciousness. That's consciousness. He's really smart. He can run different narratives simultaneously, philosophical ones, psychological ones. He's good at his narratives. He's really smart. We know other things about him, but if you've read him or paid much attention to him, it's his emotion. It's his hope. It's his courage. It's his joy. It's his love that sustained him in all this. In Chicago, there's another guy who was a city council person who is just as bright as a Barack is, just as gifted intellectually, just as versatile, but he doesn't have the emotion, the hopeful, joyful emotion to sustain the endeavor. And think about people that you admire. Usually they tapped into some really positive emotion. Look at someone like Lance Armstrong. Lance Armstrong, he got testicular cancer, right? And everybody thought he's gone. He's gone. But because of the power of his emotion, he came back. I mean, he won again. So emotion, the fourth one, is something we have to acknowledge and pay attention to. And work with. Come on in. And then we have people like Adolf Hitler. Emotion. Adolf Hitler, he was pretty bright. He was pretty bright. He was pretty shrewd, but he tapped into emotions of anger, of betrayal, and he almost took over the world through that emotion. So this fourth skanda, this fourth aggregate, is something that's very powerful for good or for evil, and sometimes for both, in our human society. In my first teacher, Suzuki Roshi, everybody says he was deeply enlightened, but I don't even know what that means anymore. I mean, I used to think I knew what it meant. He carried himself lightly, and he had a lot of joy about the Dharma. He just wanted to share it. He just felt joyful sharing it. And there was some feeling of love radiating from him, but he never talked about love. He had that emotion. He was here for 12 years in the United States. And then he died. He wasn't here very long. He was here the oldest part of his life, and he died. But he had that emotion, and that really created Soto Zen Buddhism in this country. And sustained it. So that's emotion in general. Now I want to turn back to anger in particular and talk about anger for most of the rest of the time. So anger as an emotion is very pervasive in most people's lives. It's often pent up, and it comes from insecurity, the need to succeed, to dominate, to feel that we're loved, that we're valued, that you're not going to go to sleep in my talk, and if you do, okay, etc. Right? That's anger. And that there's a place for us. We want to have a place in the universe, and we're angry when we don't. We get angry. It causes us to act stupidly. We act stupid when we're angry, and then afterwards we go, geez, I did that again. Whoops. How old am I? How long have I been doing whatever I've been doing to work on myself? We feel stupid. And we can be destructive, and anger can be very addictive too, as you know. It has so much power. Oh, people pay attention to us. Everybody pays attention immediately when we're angry. So, finally they're paying attention to me. Wow. And we don't know how addictive it is, but that's why we depend on it so much. That's why we do it over and over and over again. Because it has this addictive quality in it, and we get a kind of a high from it. It's energy. It's focus. It's power. We don't think of it as power, but it is. Last time I was talking about 2001 World Trade Center. So 2001 World Trade Center planes crashing. So we were angry. We were angry. Everybody was angry, at least, especially people who lost loved ones. And our administration was angry, right? The trio of Bush, Cheney, and Rumsfeld were angry. And that's natural to be angry. Did they deny their anger? No. Some people probably denied their anger, but those three guys sure didn't. Did they repress their anger? No. Some people probably did. Some family members had to repress it for a while, had to wait till they were ready to let the anger come through. What they did is this is a classic example of magnifying and generalizing the anger. They magnified it. They magnified it. Their anger toward what these fellows had done to us all of a sudden became these people are awful. They're awful. They're incorrigible. They're beyond the pale. And so when we're dealing with them, we put them in Guantanamo. They're so awful. Our court system can't handle with people. These are awful because they might get off. So the more we think about how awful we are, the more Guantanamo becomes necessary to protect ourselves, because these people are going to get us again. So we need, they'll figure out how to get through the court system, and then they'll get us again. And then we get more angry, and then we put more guards at Guantanamo. And then a year goes by, and then 2 years goes by. And then people say after 4 years, it's time to do something. But they say, no. Because they keep putting fuel on the fire, the magnification of anger, and then they generalize so much they've got to invade Iraq. I mean, give me a break. What does what these fellows did have to do with Iraq? But they generalize the whole Muslim world out there, the whole Middle East, except for the Israel. They're all out to get us. They hurt us. They want to hurt us. Look what they did. Look what they're doing to women. Look what they did, da-da-da. The more we think about it, the more it becomes the them. And with the, and you know, I'm picking on Bush, Cheney, and Rumsfeld, but I could be picking on Tim when he was young and the counterculture and the counter and the culture, the establishment and the, you know, the establishment. You know, went through all that stuff, right? Some of you were with me. Anger. It's a mechanism of survival. So we're hardwired. It's good. We need it. We need to survive. If not, it'd be people be blowing up all the buildings all the time. We need to have anger. So how do we work with anger? Well, it's not easy to say how we work with anger, but I've just got a few thoughts. First of all, we can figure out how to work with anger, and all of our strong emotion, all of the energy that comes from our strong emotions, and we can, you have to believe this if you're going to do this practice. You have to believe that you can work with it, that you can use your anger or purify it and channel it so you're not pushed around by it anymore. You're not pushed around by its irrationality, by its destructiveness, by its pain, by the suffering you cause for yourself and others. You have to have that belief as a Buddhist practitioner, as a human being. And then when you have that belief that you can do it, that you can work with it, then begin to notice that anger is information. It's telling you something. It's informative. It's informing you that your mind and your heart are in pain. Just the way a pain in my down here in my knee is informing me that I probably should not be sitting in half lotus too much more as I get to this aged age, probably just for shorter periods of time. It's informing me. It's saying, Tim, hey, you know, you are not 30 years old anymore. Well, you are not 35 years old anymore, et cetera, et cetera. Right? So that pain is telling me something. Anger in your heart, in your mind, is telling you something. There's some pain. There's some pain. And we're thwarted. We're frustrated, and that pain needs attention, just like the pain in my knee needs attention. And if we look at our anger in the face, then we have an opportunity to change and grow. Just to change and grow and become larger and more compassionate. And the key is in this practice that we do here at Zen Center, this meditation practice, this mindfulness practice, this bare attention practice, is to bring it into view without incessantly feeding it with the fifth one, with the consciousness, with the da-da-da-da-da, what we say to ourselves. Over and over again. And this is part of the practice of bringing all of the skandhas into view, bringing our physical contact into awareness, our perceptions, our sensations, and all of our emotions, and then all of the thoughts that we have about that stuff, bringing that stuff into view. Over and over and over again in our sitting practice. And, of course, part of our sitting practice is concentration when we're trying not to bring that stuff into view, which is fine because you have to be concentrated enough not just to be dominated by the fifth one. If you're just sitting here in Zazen and you're doing nothing but the fifth one, nothing but chat, chat, chatter, 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 so you don't even notice any of the feelings, any of the sensations, any of the sights and feelings, then that's really not mindfulness, not bare attention, not even Zazen, really. So there has to be an effort to bring them into view, to bring them all into view. They're the basic components of who we are, of what is. So if we make that effort, then the fifth one begins to decrease its incessant need to weave a web around all the others. Our thinking, our talking, our chattering weaves a web that constrains our perception, that constrains our feeling, that constrains our just being aware of our physicality, of our body, of our contact. It's constrained by that web. And we, in our sitting practice, in our mindfulness practice, or in just bare attention outside, you know, not the Zendo, outside the Zen, we have a chance to see this, to see the web. And the beginning of seeing it is the beginning of being free from it. So that web begins to, we see it's just a web. It's just this, it has, you know what a spider web looks. You know when you look at a spider web, how it catches all those bugs in it. But you just put your finger by it and it dissolves immediately. It's just gone. It's just gone. And that's our practice. We just come to it. We just be with it. So that we let perceptions be what they are. I just let my perception of a guy's droopy eyes be what it is. I just let it be there. I don't have to make a huge story about guy, about how he's doing or not doing as my protege, right? And then if I see I'm doing a story, oh, there it is. There's consciousness doing its story. Oh, consciousness has a value, an important value. I need to think about how I can work with Guy as my protege, how I can pay attention to him, give him advice, give him support. I need to think about that stuff. But I don't need to overdo it the way human beings do. With a spider web, not spider web, human web, you guys do. This is what Zazen is about, seeing this web. Seeing this web so that you can see that it's made of nothing. But what is it? It's the spit from the spider? Is that what it is? I don't know. That's what it's made out of, spit. Spit! and yet it hypnotizes you for your life. For your life. It doesn't have to for your whole life. It doesn't have to. I promise you, it doesn't have to do that. So we let the skandhas be what they are. We let the anger be what it is. It's not Tim's anger. We always talk about owning anger. Yes, in therapy we own anger. Well, owning anger is important, meaning that you don't repress it or deny it, right? But then, disown it. Because it's nothing. It's just more stuff. Own it, but then disown it. You need to own it, I think, so that you don't repress it, so you don't deny it. But then let it be anger. Not Tim's anger, not Guy's anger, not Marty's anger, just anger. Then we don't have to continually, incessantly chatter about it and try to negotiate with it and try to get away from with it or transmute it or transform it or whatever. Right? So as many of you know, I direct a nonprofit that helps people with serious and persistent mental illness. I've done that for a long time, and I come from a family where I had a brother who committed suicide, and I have a sister with schizophrenia, and I had a mother who was marginalized culturally, even though she was upper middle class, because she was considered to be, she was marginalized because we have this huge stigma of 1,000 years of mental illness, and Freud decided that the church was wrong about mental illness. That mental illness wasn't due to the devil. church was wrong. It wasn't due to immorality. It was due to who? The mom. Yeah, the mom. Yeah. So, I mean, that's what my mother faced. That's what she faced. My mother was she was a well-educated psychologist way back then. Not a psychologist, a social worker. But she majored in psychology, at a good school. And the doctors all told her it was her fault. And she would never say anything to me about it. It was like there was this mystery. You know something's really stigmatized when nobody in the family talks about it, right? In those days, no one in the family talked about depression, about bipolar disorder, about schizophrenia. Remember those days? Not too long ago. So I was angry about that stuff. I was angry and confused. And it's 35 years since my brother's suicide. And when I think about it, I still get angry. Isn't that interesting? Isn't that interesting? How many kalpas would I have to do zazen? How many incarnations before that anger doesn't come up? Well, in Buddhism, we say the seeds of anger, once they're implanted, they're probably going to be there. They're commonly going to be there. But how do you deal with it? How do you deal with it? And through bare attention, you can go right into that anger, and you can work with its energy, you can work with its focus, and you can let go of its content. Just let go of its content. So in my other work, this is work outside of here, this is a great benefit to me that I can, when it comes up, I can just let go of it, but I've still got its energy and its focus. So that I'm 65 and I don't want to retire. I feel like I'm just getting started to changing this culture and really developing good community-based programs for people with mental illness. And in a way, that's why. That's why. So, but we do say that these seeds from the past, when we're talking about anger, that they dwell in our storehouse consciousness in Buddhism. Storehouse consciousness, our unconscious. This is the Buddhist unconscious. And so we've all got lots of anger seeds from the past. And if we're older, you've got more of them, right? By the time you get to be my age, you go, whew! But that's not bad. That's what they are. They're seeds. They're seeds, and they were the calcification of memories, emotional memories, which became calcified and then lodge in this Buddhist unconscious. They're waiting to be activated by monkey mind, by consciousness. But they don't need to be activated. They don't need to be activated. The activating them is drawing on their consent, our content, and it creates a toxic situation, which can be worked with, so that these seeds don't dominate our lives. They dominate our lives when they turn into dysfunctional behaviors over and over and over again. And it's not that we ever expel them. It's just that we can develop the capacity not to feed them with our thinking, with our talking. You can develop that capacity, each of you. Each of you. So, can I look at a copy of the program? So, Thich Nhat Hanh has a book on anger, right? And he says a few things. He says, first, recognize anger. Recognize it. He says, then, pay attention to the feeling. Where is the feeling? Pay attention to it. What other feelings are coming in? What is it? What's its companion? Is it jealousy? Is it fear? Is it loneliness? Pay attention to the companions. Who's it hanging out with? And then breathe with it. Breathe with it. And then return awareness to your body. Don't leave the first skanda out. Don't leave the rupa skanda, the bodily skanda, the context skanda out. Return to that. keep bringing yourself back. In other talks, I've said about how in our lives, we need to pay much more attention to the first three than the fourth and the fifth. And look and see what your thoughts are. Look and see what fuel you're starting to put on the fire. What are your thoughts about that are coming up? And what other thoughts are being provoked by those thoughts? And then just let the anger be itself. Let it be itself. And you disarm it. You disarm it. So Thich Nhat Hanh has this... Thich Nhat Hanh, you know, in each of his books, he has exercises to do, which he calls gathas. And here is his anger one. Contemplating self or other in anger, I breathe in. Seeing the suffering of self or other, I breathe out. Contemplating the damage done from anger, I breathe in. Seeing that anger burns and destroys happiness, I breathe out. Seeing anger's roots in the body, I breathe in. Seeing anger's roots in the mind, I breathe out. Seeing anger's roots in misperception and confusion, I breathe in. Forgiving myself and others for misperception, I breathe out. Seeing self or others suffer from anger, I breathe in. Feeling compassion for self or others suffering in anger, I breathe out. So you can, lots of Thich Nhat Hanh's exercises are really good, and you can call on them. You can even bring them to your cushion, so you have them tucked under your cushion, and you can pull them out when you need them. I recommend it. I recommend using all the tools in your toolbox for working on making this transformation. This is not easy transformation. But ultimately, if you keep up this work, your anger won't get you anymore. It won't get you. Its toxicity is just kind of goes, just kind of gate. And your approach avoidance about it, that dance of approach avoidance, right, that just stops. And that only happens when you embrace it and see it as an ally. And you can't do this with just the fifth skanda, which is consciousness. Oh, I'm going to embrace you as an ally now. You can do that. That's planting a positive seed, but that's just not enough. And as you begin to do this practice with your anger, your mind goes slower. Whenever you're angry, your mind is usually racing. Notice how fast your mind goes when you're angry. As you begin to do this practice, as you bring yourself back to doing it again and again, your mind goes slower. Your blaming decreases. Your frustration decreases. And you may even become calm enough to find the whole thing a little bit amusing. Is that possible that you could find it amusing? Is that possible that after 35 years after my brother's death, that I could find the anger that's coming up amusing? Sure, why not? Why not? There it comes again. There it comes again. And there's the fuel on the fire. Amusing. So the anger is not your responsibility. It's not your responsibility. It rises for a reason out of your karmic past, out of your storehouse consciousness, and you can understand it, and you can be compassionate. And you can develop some poignant relationship with it, poignant relationship so that it actually deepens your intimacy. So our practice is shining a light on the skandhas. And in particular, I'm talking about the skandha of emotion now, and I'm talking about the skandha of anger, because I think more people are consumed by anger in this society, maybe in all societies. I only lived in this society. More people are crippled by anger, more people are thwarted by anger than any other emotion. And, you know, men tend to be more about it. Women tend to be more internalized. That's a generalization. And women are not. Things have been changing the last 30 years. But that was the case 40 years ago when I was young. So we shine a light on it. Our bare attention, our kind attention, shines a light on it. And that's enlightenment. That is enlightenment. If you can just shine a light on this moment of anger as it comes up, that's all you need for enlightenment. That's it, you guys. That's completely it. Moment after moment. It always takes effort because the seeds are always here. But it can be easy, easy effort, because you just do it. You just bring yourself back. So my first teacher, Suzuki Roshi, I talked about before. But here's something I haven't talked about. Once when I was with him in a room on a, I guess it was a retreat, I don't remember, and he was giving a talk. My friend John, we'll make Marty John. John was sitting up in front. And I was kind of sitting up in front, and just during the Vietnam War, during the of course the Vietnam War went for years, but this was a time when we were particularly pissed about it. Although when weren't we particularly pissed about it? So I don't know. And my friend John was an activist, and he was also trying to do Zen meditation. But he was, you know, he really tried to do both, which is good, which is great. But so much that he had that during the height of the war, he had trouble concentrating in his zazen, and we have the. The recruiting station in Berkeley, he lived close to, and he saw people being drafted and, you know, shipped off, and he was just in a stew about it. And he'd gone to this retreat, and he was sitting in this retreat about where Marty was, and Suzuki gave his talk, which was probably, I have no idea what his talk was about, except it's probably the same thing that Zen teachers always talk about, this, you know. Just what I've been talking about, right? what? John was sitting still, but Suzuki was a little bit psychic. Now, let's not take this to too much of an extreme. He knew John already. He could tell. I didn't know at the time, but I talked to John afterwards, that John wasn't really paying attention to him. That John was kind of in Berkeley, thinking about, God, you know, they're hauling more people into the draft. We had to go to Berkeley and stay overnight, and they, well, I don't know, you guys don't want to know about all that. But during the days of the draft, it was not nice. And it was hard to get out of the draft, too. Very hard. So he was not paying attention to the talk. So he said to Suzuki, well, how is this helping? Well, what you're talking about, everybody who's suffering in Vietnam. And so Suzuki talked then about how you could still your mind so you could be compassionate and still be active, but but not be caught by the content of what you were angry about, or something like that. I don't really remember. And then John came back and asked him again. And the third time John asked him, Suzuki, who was like 4'11", got up. And he took his stick, and he went over to John, and he went, whap, 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 whap. And he went, you, do you really want to get to the core of being or not? He said, do you want to just think all your life about war, or do you want to end the war? Whap. Wow! Wow! Excuse me. That was it. Then he sat down. He unrumpled his robes. He took a drink of water, and he went back to his talk. Better watch out, you guys. So then I talked to John afterwards, and John, I said, John, how are you doing? Of course, you know, this was the 60s. You know, nobody gets away with doing this kind of thing anymore. But this was the 60s in San Francisco, and these Zen teachers did that stuff. And there were no lawsuits, right? No, that's why nobody does it anymore. No lawsuits. I talked to John afterwards, and I said, John, are you okay? He said, yeah, that was very helpful. I said, helpful? He said, yeah, I was just so out of it. I just needed to be brought back to being here, and he helped me. I said, well, wasn't that painful? It sounded so loud. He said, you know, he knows how to hit with a kisaku. He knows how to hit so it doesn't hurt. That we were taught when we were young to learn how to use the kisaku, the stick, to hit people so it doesn't hurt them. He said, but no, it was very helpful. Why am I telling that story? Well, that's anger, right? I mean, that is anger. That is anger. And I'm telling that story because by that time, and because Suzuki Roshi then went on to give his talk, and it was almost as if that had never happened. He gave a kind, gentle, calm talk in which he reached out and he laughed and he joked. Because for years he had done this practice. And he was able to let it go and to use it in a skillful way. Now, if you know about his early life, for many years he had anger issues himself. And he didn't use it skillfully. But after a while, it just happens. It's just some kind of subtle transformation that takes place, so that he could do that. And then I put this also this other quote in your program. This is what he said about anger. He said, "Let anger be a great bonfire that burns itself completely away. I wish I could be like that." And he was like that. He was just humble, that's all. But that's after practicing and practicing and practicing this bare attention, this mindfulness, so that we can begin to trust that whatever rises in our mind, jealousy, anger, love, infatuation, wholesome, unwholesome, good, bad, we don't have to complain to ourselves about it. We don't have to complain to ourselves about ourselves. I mean, what good does that do? What good does that do? We don't have to be pushed around. So I'm going to now endorse coming to the retreat in 2 weeks. We're having a retreat in 2 weeks. You can come for 2 days, or you can come for 1 day. And I just want to tell you that my belief is that only through a regular sitting practice and regular attendance at retreats can you get a taste of what I'm talking about. That's my belief. You may have another belief, but that's fine. That's my belief. Because in retreat practice, you're more than just 30 minutes facing a wall. You're what? All day facing a wall. All day walking quietly and facing a wall. And all this time just to practice being with the skandhas, being with perception, being with feeling, being with emotion, and noticing your reactions without creating huge bonfires. However, what I need to qualify this with is that in retreat, as in zazen, yes, we can do this. We can learn to focus, to draw on the energy, without getting caught by the content, without repressing, without denying, without magnifying, without generalizing. We can do that. We can all do that. But in intensive meditation circumstances, more stuff comes up rather than less. I'm sorry. What do you expect? Why do you think we do it? More stuff comes up. You think, oh, finally that anger is gone. And then, oh, shit. and just some little thing that normally wouldn't even annoy you, and it really annoys you because you're just getting concentrated. You're just getting focused. And how dare they? That's the process. That's the process that we've been doing in this tradition for a couple thousand years or so. There's the possibility, though, that through this practice, we can do a lot of good. Each of us can do a lot of good in our very short lives. We can harness these positive emotions and do a lot of good and not be caught by all this spiderwebby stuff. And it takes patience. And I understand Lee talked about patience last week. So that's what it takes, patience. Belief that you can do it and patience. It's all part of waking up, just waking up. So that the anger itself, when it comes up, it's Buddha. It's God. It's timeless. It is. You think it's someplace else, but not. Okay. So I think that's enough. But I will entertain questions or comments or angry gestures. Oh, yes.
How can ever arising anger ever be funny? The Energizer Bunny.
Okay, the Energizer Bunny. What else this morning, you guys?
So this morning, my husband and I were both in our small kitchen doing our own thing. He was making his morning coffee, and I think he was doing a few dishes. My daughter had her 16th birthday party last night, so we had lots of dishes. But so then, at one point, we backed into each other, and the result of that was Dwayne spilling some of his coffee on the floor. And it was like, the first feeling was, what the heck are you doing there? You spilled my coffee, blah, 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 blah. And I'm like, well? And then I said, okay, Dwayne, we both backed into each other, and we didn't mean to be in the same spot at once. Let's just clean up the coffee and move on. And he looked okay.
Good for you. Good for you. Good for you. Okay. Something else? Some other? Yeah. I would say both. Both. Uh-huh.
And the other part of my question is judgment and anger, do you think?
Judgment is the fifth skanda. Judgment is consciousness. We judge our anger. Our anger just comes up. Rah! And then we judge it. And that's not negative. We can't cut off consciousness. There's a reason why we judge our anger. It's because we want to control. We want to work with. We want to. But judgment is the fifth one. Does that make sense? Uh-huh. Other people?
I'm curious about the three poisons.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
I wonder which translation you prefer.
Oh, I much prefer. Did you hear her question? I much prefer hatred. Mm-hmm. Hatred is one of the three main poisons. Anger, solidified, is hatred, from my point of view. Solidified, calcified, perpetuated is hatred. So we don't think of moments of hatred. We think of moments of anger. And then we think of anger turning into something that is hatred. And so while anger is on the list of unwholesome dharmas, and sometimes it's equated with hatred, I don't like that. I don't understand that psychologically. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Oh.
Interpretation, but you know, if you use extreme words like greed.
Like what?
Like greed and
anger.
You forget there's a whole spectrum
of
other kind of attachments and aversions.
Right.
Yeah, and so by only using the extreme terms,
right,
you know, it deflects from the fact that there's all kinds of.
Sure, so you're talking about the three poisons in particular, that making those predominant is maybe not so cool. Is that what you're saying?
It's a reflection of the fact that, you know, there's all kinds of attachments, et cetera.
Sure.
And to look at only the extreme,
right,
you know, it deflects from the fact that, you know, our whole life is channeled by, you know, these little attachments.
Sure.
Just make that clear.
Sure. So, apropos to his comment, in Yogacara Buddhism, which I'm teaching right now, there are lists of all the unwholesome emotions. Lists and lists. They go on, and the wholesome ones, too. They go on and on. And, they all just come up. They all create seeds. They all come up. It always seemed kind of strange that they list them as if they've got a handle on it, but that's kind of the way psychology is, isn't it? Pardon?
They were in the list.
Yeah, it's the conceit of psychology, the conceit of Buddhist psychology and Western psychology. Yeah.
Except he seemed to know everything about everything, you know. And yet he said, well, hummingbirds never land. They can't because if they don't, they never. Well, I saw hummingbirds sitting on sunsets and all the people, oh, they never land. They can't. They don't have feet that are strong. What did Dr. Jensen, why is he so ignorant? And it drove me to correct things all of my, this, what is it? So now, I don't know what to do about it. It's more what I do with it.
Well, very good. It's amazing that you could have that much insight as you were listening to me talk. That's really big mind.
Well, it's that.
Talk about the stick.
I have all day, don't I?
Oh, yeah.
You can think about what I just said.
Well, thank you. Thank you. Yeah.
I wonder if you could talk on if you are consistently setting yourself against something, how to use anger as an ally. So if it's not, if you're getting upset in traffic, that's, in my, the way I see it, that's totally absurd. Like, that, you should not be drive, you need to, deal with it. But if you're like, if somebody's constantly doing something that is socially, nobody agrees with it or likes it, but, if someone's harming, and so if you're setting yourself against somebody who's harming, I mean, that's, you're trying to reduce suffering, you're trying to help people,
right.
But, and it causes anger, how can you use that as an ally?
So how can you legitimately use anger as an ally when you want to right wrongs or help people who are hurting? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Well, I don't think there's a formula, but I do think that just paying attention to the anger, acknowledging it here, let me give myself as an example. A few years ago, I wanted to open a program, a residential program for people with mental illness and chemical dependency. The neighbors were trying to keep us out of the neighborhood, right? And this stuff about my brother kept coming up. I won't go into those details, but it kept coming up. And so my anger kept coming up. These neighbors had nothing to do with my brother. That's 35 years ago. That was in another part of the world where it's nice and 70 degrees in the winter. There could be a part of the world like that. but there I am in St. Paul over by Metro State, and these neighbors are trying to keep this program out that I've worked so hard to start. So my anger is coming up. It's coming up. It's coming up. Well, here's my chance for bare attention. And I can't run back to Zen Center for my cushion. I'm just there. But I can breathe. I can breathe. And I can feel, I can have that feeling of anger without just getting caught in my head trip about how this person is so bad, how they don't understand, how they're insensitive. I can just be with this experience. I can come back to my body. I can embody it. I can come back to my feeling underneath my anger of despair. Again, from years ago, despair. And then I can look at that person with actually some generosity, because I see that their fear is not different from the fear that I'm feeling in my body right now. Their fear of what I'm trying to do is no different. So there can be empathy. And that's our practice. That's our life. On or off the cushion. And it doesn't always work. But if it doesn't work, then maybe someone is there. Maybe a Dharma friend or a wife is there. Just go like this. You know, Tim, this is 2008 in Minnesota. This is not 19 whatever it was in California. These people are doing their best. They're doing their best. They're afraid. They want to protect their children. So we can all do it, but if we don't do the practice outside of the community, it's hard for us to do it in the community because we get thrown off. I mean, first we need to practice to bear our attention without distraction. If we can learn to practice it without distraction, then when we're in a situation where people are coming at us, we can stay pretty calm and see it come up. Oh, there it goes again. Oh my, there it is again. There's my anger and my pain about the loss of my brother. I still feel. He was only 30. He was only 30. No.
Can I add something to that?
Sure.
So, were you here last week? Okay, because last week Lee was talking about the Paramita, and he was talking about patience being the antidote to anger, and he actually told a story very similar to Tim's about building this building in Northeast that his
Did he?
agency was doing. And there are people in the community who are very upset about
Did he?
And so he was talking about patience and forbearance as the antidote to anger.
Good. Thank you. Thank you. Anything else? Yeah, sure.
Could you just comment a little bit about forgiveness?
Forgiveness. Yeah. Well, forgiveness is very, very important, but forgiveness can't be rushed. If you move too fast from your anger toward forgiveness, it's not real. It's not whole. It's not really being, really inhabiting. Forgiveness is wonderful, and anything you can do to move in that direction is wonderful, but mostly you move in that direction by being with the anger. Intimate, close to it, feeling it, not judging it. That's the door to forgiveness. That's the door. And of course, you can try to create other doors, but most of those doors are just kind of fake doors. Does that make sense? Okay, thank you. Sure.
What about prayer?
What about prayer? So do you want to say something? You have something more to say? What about prayer?
How much work do you put? Does it have to put work to it, as well as just the intention?
Can you, what did you say? Sorry.
You have to speak up.
I have a hearing problem. I think prayer is great, and prayer is using the fifth skanda, the fifth, which is consciousness. In a way, I mean, you may be thinking of prayer differently than I am, but this is kind of a prayer that I read, of Thich Nhat Hanh. He's praying. He's doing it with focus. He's doing it with energy. He's praying. Now, he's doing it in a way where he's not asking, but asking is good. Asking for support. So prayer is wonderful. We don't have any God out there that we pray for who's separate from us. We just pray. We just pray. That praying is also a way of calming down the fifth aggregate. It calms the fifth aggregate down. It calms the monkey mind down, the act of prayer. So that it can be open to the sensation, to the color, to the feeling, to the hurt. Does that make sense? A little bit of sense? Okay. A little bit of sense. All right.